everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators, where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today we'll be talking about structure in the classroom, structure in your lessons, and everything else that has to go into helping our kids succeed. Hello, everyone. I am sitting here today with a good friend of mine, Keisha Dennis, K-E-C-I-A. How we doing, Keisha?
Hi, Jacob. I'm doing great.
Yeah? Nothing's going too on. Nothing's too exciting this weekend?
Nope. No excitement this weekend. It's a down weekend. No games, no parades, no nothing to do. I got some papers to grade.
And we all have papers to grade. It's about that time of year.
Yep.
Which that reminds me, I need to do a grading podcast. It would be the most exhilarating episode. Just
I'm not sure that you could do anything that would help anybody that's just there. You just have to do it.
It would just exist to raise the anxiety level.
Oh, well, that's true. It would do that.
all right. Anyway, so today, the reason why, I wanted you on the podcast today was because I don't think it's any secret to anyone who knows you that you have got structure on lock when it comes to your class. Both when classroom structure and how you use structures specifically in your class to enhance your lessons and enhance the learning in your room, right? Anytime someone's like, hey, you need to learn structures, go watch Keisha Teach for a little bit. That's what I heard my first year, and it's what I keep hearing people say, you know, to the new teachers and people who are helping like that. So I figured you have some helpful advice for everyone listening, at least a little bit, right? Everyone has little nuggets that they need to share.
I just have experiences.
That's good. You got some good experiences. So we're going to get to a lot of that. But before, as always, before we get to some of the nitty-gritty of structure and really what we're talking about with that, I want you just to tell us a little bit about yourself. That way we can fill in some informational gaps about people who may think they know where you came from, but they have no idea. What's that from? What's that show? You think you know, but you have no idea. MTV's Idol? Was that what it was?
No.
It was something.
I don't know.
Anyway, so where'd you come from? Where are you at now?
Well, I grew up in a family that was very heavy on education. My mom's a teacher. My dad worked for General Motors. My mom loved education the entire time she was little. She skipped a couple grades. She is very into books. She was a librarian. My dad got through school, and he always wanted us to do really well at school, and we knew early on that school was my thing. And because I grew up in Louisiana, school's not really a thing for anybody, but school was my thing. It was the one thing that I knew that I could excel at because I started reading really early. I loved books, and books were my thing. So I was a GT kid. There was never a lesson that I couldn't get into, but I ran my mouth a lot. So behavior was sometimes an issue. Never big trouble, but I got bored really quickly in class, so I would want to talk to people. I went through school, made great grades, did not study very much, but did not enjoy it for the most part. So I graduated. I had a child. I went to college while I had a child. I had another child, got married, moved to Texas, all while still focusing on being an avid reader and writing, because writing was my main focus to start with. I wanted to be a writer. I love poetry and writing and just getting feelings out. So I decided that I wanted to be a teacher because in writing some things that I was writing, somebody in a consult group with me was talking about, you know, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. And that was the topic for this day that we were there. And I went on this long rant basically about how that's the biggest lie that we tell children, because words have powers to start wars. Words literally can take the breath out of people without you ever laying a hand on them. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I needed to change what I wanted to do. Because at that point I was going to go to law school, and I wanted to be a juvenile judge. That was my end point. And I thought it would be more beneficial for me to be on the education side to keep kids from even getting into this law system than to try to save them once they got there. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I was going to be a teacher when I finished, and I stayed at home with my girls to make sure their education had a solid foundation. And when they became old enough in sixth and in third grade, I went to get a job and started teaching at Richland Middle School. And 8 years later, here I am now.
Man, that's crazy.
It all works.
Yeah.
there are different paths to where we got to get to sometimes.
I'm always fascinated by how like people become teachers. Because I became a teacher for like literally right out of college. So it's just interesting to see the route some people take.
Well, I saw some things with my own girls that I wanted to change. And I knew that they had to have a strong foundation for education. And I felt like other kids needed that too. And not that I have the magic pill to cure education. Mm-hmm. But there are just some things that I think need to be done and some things kids need to hear that I like to share in my class.
So when it comes to students needing something, would you say structure is one of those things that kids need today?
Absolutely. Kids need structure probably more than they need the numbers and the letters that we give them in our lessons. If kids have structure, they know exactly what to expect. Things are not up in the air, and they don't have to be fearful of anything because the structure's already there. They know what's going to happen, or they know what outcome is supposed to happen.
So what structure to you?
Structure to me means that there is a clearly communicated expectation for students and for myself. Now, of course, structure can change in the middle of something depending on what's going on. And structure is different for every single class depending on the dynamic of the people that are in that class. But walking into my classroom, structure is definitely a clearly communicated thing that kids already have been told. They see it before them. They have it repeated. They have it given to them. They get to own it. They get to tell each other about it. They get to say to each other, that's not what we're supposed to do. This is what we're supposed to do. It's clearly laid out procedures, clearly laid out lessons, clearly laid out expectations so that they know what they're supposed to meet. And they know that I am always there to help them meet it.
So do you think, like when we're talking structure, do you think a lot of people or a lot of teachers come into the class and they're afraid to use structure because they're afraid to like stifle students? Do you think there's a fear when it comes to enforcing this type of, like a fear of putting yourself into a box is basically kind of what I'm asking. Because I feel like for instance, let's bring it back to a personal experience for me. I'm like, I hate being constrained, like down to like, I hate waking up at the same time. So by golly, I'm going to wake up at a different time every morning just because that's the kind of person I am. I fight structure all the time. So do you think that is something that teachers are almost afraid to do because you have this whole idea of letting minds grow and expand? Do you think that comes into a lack of structure in the classroom?
I think teachers that don't understand how structure works are afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who's ever been in my classroom knows that there is an incredible amount of freedom in my classroom because of the structure that has been given to them. I don't have the fight about cell phones. I don't have the fight about, you know, getting up out of your seat and doing things because within the structure that I have laid out for them, they know exactly what they're supposed to do and they know when they're supposed to do it. So I don't have 10 kids asking me in the middle of me standing in front of the room teaching, can I listen to my music? Well, they know that that's not acceptable. They know that when it's time for them to do their bell ringer, it is totally silent. They know that when it's time for independent work, it's okay if you get up and move around and do something or go to an anchor chart on the wall or go do things. The structure in my classroom that I have is because I felt like I was always put in that box when I was in school, because everything had to be the same for everyone. Structure is not the same for everyone. Structure is the same expectation and the same goal maybe for everyone on a certain lesson or a certain task, but you have to do different things within the structure to get there for yourself. So it's actually an incredible amount of freedom that I don't have to correct things 10 times. They get to own it. After you get a structure laid down in your classroom, the kids will police themselves. They'll police each other. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible amount of freedom for them and for me. I get to freely walk around and do things and help those that need it and know that two tables over, they're already on track and already going. And if someone needs help there, they will help each other. It's a lot of freedom in being able to choose instead of be told what to do every single second.
So how do you start building that structure from day one? What elements do you specifically look at that you kind of set up these perimeters and this structure for them in your class?
Well, I think a big part of it is starting day one. Mm-hmm. If you wait a week to start building structure in your class, you've already lost them. They've already learned how to train you. So you have to start training them from the second they walk in. Have your board set up the way that you're going to do it all year long. Have things in place so that they see on the first day that this is what we're going to do. So that they understand this is what's going to happen. This is what I expect of you. This is what you're going to be able to do. Don't ever wait for those kind of opportunities, because it's too important for you to set it up and give them the freedom to control it themselves. I think that one of the things that I do is I open myself up to my students very quickly. I let them know that I value their voice, I value what they have to say, and that my classroom is a place that they get to say it. They get to say it respectfully. They get to disagree. They get to argue. They get to say all the things that they may not be able to say somewhere else. And I open myself up to them very quickly by letting them know my experience in feeling stifled in school and letting them know that I felt like a lot of times I was just sitting there and the learning was not tailored to me. It was tailored to everybody has to do this. And I hated it. And I don't want them to feel like that. I want them to get the things that they need. I want their learning style and their intelligence to come through. You have to have structure in order to do that. So you build that the very first day so that they know it's all right and it's safe to do this. Safety is a huge factor in being able to have structure.
So how do you make them feel safe? Is that just showing your willingness to do that, or how do you create that safety net before they're comfortable? Because if you're talking the first week, first days, I mean, they're nervous. They have all kinds of anxieties. You teach eighth grade, so a lot of them have been in school with each other for quite a while. They got kids they hate. They got kids they like. They got kids that, you know, they don't really understand. So what does that safety net look like when you're building it in the beginning?
I think vulnerability is a big part of that safety net. Once kids know that you are human, kids still see teachers as this faraway thing. They think we are all super smart on every subject. They think we are untouchable people, that they don't have things in common with us. And I start on the first day breaking those barriers down, letting them know. I remember being in eighth grade. It's been a while, but I still remember. So being vulnerable and showing them those kind of things helps. One of the things that I, in the last 3 or 4 years, have done on the first day is ask them what they have heard. I have a reputation for being mean and being hard on students. And so I ask them, you know, what have you heard? You know, and I tell them, it's all right. You could say it. I don't care, you know. And so they immediately are at ease because I tell them, well, yes, I do that. This is why. And I tell them, well, that's not true. I never did that. That did not happen. You know, there's this wonderful go around of punching people in the throat. I've never punched a student in the throat. But of course, they all believe that I have. So I make them comfortable and let them know that my classroom is a place where they're going to be able to express themselves, where they're going to be able to talk, where they're going to be able to stand up for what they believe in. And they're going to be able to do it respectfully, and we understand what respect means. That's another thing that we do very early on. We talk about what respect means. So the students feel safe fairly quickly because I am who I am. There is no dog and pony show. I tell them this is what's going to happen. This is what we're going to do. So they know already what to expect.
When you're you're building that initial structure and that safety, is that, do you build that into when you're kind of saying your class rules as well, when you're kind of laying down the framework?
Absolutely. Because when they walk in, my board is set up the exact same way that I want to set it up all school year. So I don't do anything in a way that's, look, this is our first day of school, let's do this. I do it in the way that I would teach them a lesson. I have them do things in a way that I would have them do it in class. I have them read silently on the first day. I had them share with a partner on the first day. I had them get up and move around the classroom on the first day. It was difficult because we had shortened class periods, but I had already built that in so that they know this is what's going to happen. This is the kind of thing that's going to happen in this classroom every single day. So they weren't shocked 2 weeks in when I said, okay, turn to your partner and share your idea. Well, they already knew. They did that on the first day. So even the most shy child had to share on the first day.
Silent read, talk, move around the room. Are those the three things that are kind of like the pillars of your classroom that you hold everything up on? Or?
I don't know that I would say they're the pillars of my classroom, because I really think the biggest pillar of my classroom is conversation and analysis of topics, that we are not just talking about what is happening in the story, but why it's happening and how the author conveys it and how things happen. But I think you have to use those things in order to get to that point. You have to, they have to read silently. There's no choice. They have to do it. It's part of what we do. So I made sure that it was vital information that they needed in order for them to really know that they really needed to read that silently. If they didn't get the information, then they couldn't do the part where they had to go say something to someone, because you have to read it to find out what you even have to say. Then they had to keep reading in order to know what to get up and do. So those things happen in my classroom just about every day. But once I presented all of those things to them, they now know, oh, she made us do this. Most first days probably look like sit and listen, not get up and do. So I'd rather them get up and do, so that they know that this is how the classroom just is going to be.
So how do you go about like classroom setup? Because this kind of connects to structure of the class. What's the brainchild behind, you know, how you decide where to put students and how to group them together?
The first week or so, I don't group them. I like to observe personalities and behavior. I want to see who they sit next to. I do give them something different every day to seat them the first week. The first day, I don't give them any parameters. They sit wherever they want with whomever they want. I watch who's talking. I watch who's dating. I watch who hates whom. So that you find a lot by observing eighth graders. The second day, I tell them to sit at a table with two different people that they didn't sit with yesterday. So now I've automatically scrambled the room. The third day, I will tell them to sit at a table with two boys and two girls. So now I've scrambled the room again. And that it's always some sort of restriction that makes them sit somewhere else. And then on the last day, I tell them to sit at a table with three people they haven't sat with all week. Well, that gets to be really difficult depending on the size of the class. If you have 25, 30 kids in a class, it's pretty easy. But if you have 15, now you're running into a problem. They generally work it out to where most of them do that, and then the other ones I just tell, go ahead and sit down. But after that first week, I generally, the second week, place them by personality, and I don't sit them next to their best friend. I've already figured out who their best friend is in that first week, so they're across the room from each other generally. By the third week, we have done some sort of task or some sort of activity to where I group them heterogeneously, so that we have some different levels at each table, so that we have the ability to help each other and to do some things within our group, so that they aren't just all grouped with one like type of student. You know, the kids that make all A's, they're friends with other kids that make all A's. Mm-hmm. The kids who don't do well and have trouble reading, they're friends with the kids that have trouble reading. If you put those kids together, they can help each other in different ways so that both of them can grow in some way in the classroom.
Do you ever find that, like, when you make a heterogeneous group,
mm-hmm.
right? For those who don't know the word, you know, this is like, you know, different levels of academic success, mm-hmm. I guess would be a good way to describe mm-hmm. it. Do you ever find that once you get those groups together and, you know, you craft it and you put them all together, that, like, sometimes it's just, like, it just doesn't work in some groups?
Absolutely. I put the kids in their groups and I tell them, I have the option to move you at any time. I will move them if they get together and start chatting too much, they get together and they just cannot get along, I will move them. And then usually if I move one, I have to move three. Because I have to, you can't just move, switch two, because then you have some other weird combination that messes you up. So generally, I tell them, if I switch somebody, you're going to displace somebody else. So behave. Do what you're supposed to do. Do your part. Be accountable for what you're responsible for. So they know, and they don't like it if one person gets moved, because two or three people are going to get moved at the same time. So it fails all the time. Every single time I move them, it fails. I will build a group, and I will think to myself, what was I thinking when I put them together? And since I have tables in my classroom, I can build the perfect group. But if they're sitting next to another perfect group, but the two ends meet and they're not perfect together, now I have another problem. So it fails all the time. And that's the great part of it. You tell them from the beginning, I have the liberty to move you anytime I want.
Yeah, that's... I don't know. I was doing that this last week, because when we're getting week five of the 6 weeks, sixth graders are starting to come out of the shell a little bit. Yep. You know, in my classroom, they're starting to be a little bit more them.
Yes.
So I'm starting to see, and I'm like, oh, okay. You know, yep. I moved more people this week than I had, you know, all year so far. So
failure of that is just a way for you to learn, oh, I know what I can't do now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a way to teach them how to learn some self-control.
Yeah.
Because I never move them on the first time something happens. I talk to them about it. I tell them, hey, you want to sit there? You got to do this, this, and this. They need to learn some self-control. We're not going to be able to move them so that they won't do something the whole time they're in school. So they have to learn self-control.
How often do you switch the groups around? Like, do you just, like, kind of scramble everything up? And then how often are you team building with those groups?
At the beginning, I switched the groups pretty often, but not the entire group all the time. I will do half group switches, so two people will stay and two people will leave. And the kids tend to like that because, you know, if there's someone they don't get along with, I've kind of seen that already in 5 weeks, and I will move them. I do change the groups every 6 weeks, no matter what. At some point during the 6 weeks, I change them. Sometimes I will let it lapse a little bit if something good is really happening in one of the groups, or I will just move those people from that table to another table. They'll go from table four to table six, but I still try to put the two people together that are having success. So you have to really watch that. I scramble it as many times as I need to. Mm-hmm. Generally, someone is moving every other day. At some way, somehow, someone is moving every other day.
So how often do you team build with them?
I team build with them, I would say, probably 2 or 3 times a week. And I do it in short spurts. So they get to do a round robin or a rally robin or something where they get to share really quickly that takes maybe 2-3 minutes. But they are learning something about each other. So 2 to 3 times a week. Sometimes, some weeks I've done it every single day. At the beginning, I try to do it more often when I see that there are 5 or 6 kids that have just come to our school. Well, we got to do it more often because they need to learn that this is what we're going to do. So last week, I did it every day, I'm pretty sure. The week before, I probably did it 4 days out of the week. It's just, you have to read your kids and know how much you have to do it. Some of my pre-AP classes, they don't have to team build. They've known each other since kindergarten. They've been tracked together since kindergarten. They were all in class together last year. They already are too comfortable with each other. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to do it as much. It has to be tailored to each one of your classes.
How do you know, what are some warning signs that you see when you're sitting in a class, you're like, oh, we got to start team building. What are some things that pop up that make you do it?
The slightest movement, breath, pass of paper that sets someone off. When it's time to team build, even if I have not scheduled it, you will see the anger or the blow up with someone over something that is very, very tiny. And you go, oh, okay. We need a team build. There's some disconnect. Because generally, people don't get mad because you pushed their paper across the table and it slid to the left. But when that happens, it's a breakdown. We need to get some team building happening.
Do you ever have the battle? Like, because I've, you know, you talk to some teachers and they're like, well, when do I have time to team build, right? Because it's just one more thing you have to put in your list of plans. You are going to do all these things. Later in the week, there's an assembly, so you know you're going to lose that time. You know, you have announcements. You have all this stuff. You have papers to pass back. You have all these millions of things to do. And then on top of that, it's like, well, we have to class build and make sure you do this or team build. Is there ever a time where you have a battle and, like, you know you have to do it, but you want to do the academics? Like, how does that war work in your brain? Do you always side with team build or class build, or sometimes does academics win?
I always side with making sure there's harmony in my classroom. So I'm going to do the team building and class building.
It's a hard choice.
It is a hard choice. The academics are going to happen all the time, but I can send academics home with them. Mm-hmm. I can put academics on Google Classroom. I cannot have them build rapport and cohesiveness with each other outside the classroom. I can give them homework. They can do something that we didn't finish in class on their own. But if you are constantly having battles in your classroom between kids, I don't have time to break up fights. So I have time to build class cohesiveness. I have time to build teams that work together and work to make each other better. So if I don't want to constantly be putting out fires, I have the time to make sure that my class runs the way that I want it to run.
You've talked about the brain science behind why structures work and why people should use them. Mm-hmm. But this isn't something that a lot of people have available for them. They don't have the research. They haven't been to trainings that talk about it. So if you could just spend a few seconds talking to us about kind of the brain science as you understand it as to why in the world structures work and why we should be using them with our students.
People are social by nature. So structures give people the chance to feed their brain the social aspects of living with the academic aspect. The brain science behind it is that you take accountability and responsibility for the things you need to do along with being social so that you don't have to crave that social time. You get to get things done. You get to say them out loud. You get to hear them. So you are now doing more and more of the time so that you are getting more out of an academic lesson. You're not only writing it and having it for yourself, but you're writing it, you're saying it, you're sharing it, you're teaching it to each other in the classroom. So being able to feed your brain the different things that it needs, getting that oxygen to your brain so that you're not falling asleep, so that you're not bored, mm-hmm. Those different kinds of things are all part of structures.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was watching today, Stephen King, he was doing a speech on literacy. He just got some award, you know, I don't even know what it was for, but he got some award. He was giving a speech. It's Facebook Live, so it just popped up, so I just clicked on it and listened to it in the background while I was cleaning my house. And he was talking about, because he was an English teacher for 2 to 3 years before Carrie took off his first book. And he said the one thing that he, you know, he would be super excited for whatever he was teaching. I'm pretty sure he taught high school English. He would, you know, stand in the class, and before the bell rang, they had, you know, these bright eyes, and, you know, they were all excited for whatever that was happening in the day. Lesson starts, they're dead for 45 minutes, or however long his class was, and then they don't come back alive until the bell rings again. And, you know, he taught, you know, it was probably like in the 80s, 70s, or whatever. So, and it's interesting that we're talking about brain science now, because, you know, every time I walked into your classroom, kids are moving around, kids are interacting with each other, kids are doing some type of structure where they're forced to come out of their, come out of like the, just sitting there like an automaton and listen to the wise old teacher talk forever, right? Like, you don't talk that much in your class.
I don't talk. Some days I feel guilty for getting paid because I'm doing very little of the talking. I want them to be doing the talking 40 minutes out of class.
And it's, well, honestly, it's literally the best thing in the world, because teachers are always like, well, how do I get my kids to stop talking? Blah, blah, blah. It's like, you don't. You get them to talk about what you need them to talk about.
Absolutely. And the fear of little Johnny across the room being off task goes away when you walk around and you just pop into their conversation and leave quickly. I go around to their tables, and if someone says an answer, I'm like, really, why do you think that? How do you know that? And I will walk away. And they will start questioning themselves. Their teammates will start questioning them. They will do what they're supposed to do if you give them that opportunity to be able to speak freely. Trying to make them be quiet the whole time is going to make them want to talk more.
Yeah, because it's, well, it's not in their nature. I mean, especially for our groups of students, you know, we have, I mean, they're young. And, yeah, you know, it didn't go the way. I mean, if you sit in a train with a bunch of teachers and see how many of them are quiet.
None of them.
they're doing all kinds of things.
Yes.
So we shouldn't, you know, my philosophy and, you know, your philosophy and kind of everyone else who kind of takes this on is, you know, why would we ask them to do something that we're not going to do ourselves?
Absolutely.
Worst trainings in the world is when you have to go there and sit.
Yes. And when I basically check out about 10 minutes in because someone is just wah, 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 wah.
Well, and then the thing that they're talking about is making an interactive lesson.
Yes. And it's the least interactive that I've been the entire year.
Yeah. I think that's where this structure piece comes in, and using that, the brain science, to really enhance the way we look at our lesson plans. Because if we're kind of staring at our lesson plans, and it's a lot like, you know, I'm going to go through this PowerPoint, I'm going to talk about this, I'm going to give them this definition, they're going to read silently. When are they doing something? Like, when are they interactive? Copying something isn't doing something.
Oh, they're doing something. They're texting under their leg.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're throwing paper across the room. They're asleep with their eyes open. They're doing something while you're doing all of that. It's not what you want them to do, but they're doing something.
And that's, I think that's the greatest thing structure, this type of structure adds to a classroom, is it allows your kids to be kids.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's a structure, it's almost like you put these invisible walls around it, and if you do it right, they think they're
totally free.
Yeah, and they're not. They're working, and they're inferencing, and they're doing all these big, hard concepts that are hard to do in real life, but they feel more free because
they feel free because they're able to talk and move and say whatever they want, and I actually have more control because now I don't have two students jumping out of their seat, ooh, pick me, pick me. I have every kid in the classroom talking, saying, doing something to do with the lesson. So I actually have more control by giving them more control.
So before we get into specifics about actual structures that you're using, I am curious how, you know, if your students are talking, right, and if they're interacting, what are you doing to formally assess what they know? Like, you as the teacher, what is your actions to figure out where they're at with all of this conversation going on?
I'm constantly monitoring and dropping into their conversations. But one thing that I also do is, if I hear something that is really good or a really good question, I literally will stop the entire class and throw it out there. Because if one group is finding greatness, every group needs to hear it, because another group may not have gotten to that point or may not be able to get to that point. So I think stopping them and giving them the chance to talk and question each other is a huge part of making sure that they are on track and that they're getting everything that they need. But I'm constantly questioning and popping in and dropping little bits of doubt in front of them, because if you make a face and walk away, they're going, well, why'd you do that? What was that for? What'd we miss? You know, and then they will dig even deeper to try to find things, and they're not even sure what they're looking for. Yeah. Because I really just made a face because I saw you sitting there, so I made a face. But it drives them to find out more.
Yeah, my first year, John Bowles, who we interviewed a few episodes back, our academic coach, he told me something that was like, it blew my mind as a first year teacher, because he goes, he asked me, you know, how am I formally assessing, and you know, mm-hmm. how, I know, typical, you know, first year student or first year teacher answer. I was like, you know, I ask them a question, they raise their hand and they respond. And he goes, throw a structure in, move around the room. Now because when you get that one, well, you tell me, right? When you ask someone a question, what are you getting when they raise their hand?
If you throw a question out just to the whole class?
Yeah, this is without a structure, so we're going back to old way. So you ask a question, you go, all right, kids, what's the theme of this? And they raise their hand. What are you getting if that's all you do?
You're getting animosity. That one or two kids that raises their hand every single time is becoming the most hated person in your classroom, because half of the kids feel inferior. They can't do what that kid can do, so they automatically hate them, and they hate you for pointing out that they're not as smart as little Sally and little Billy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half of the kids are just as smart, can do it, have the answer, and don't care, because only one person's getting to talk.
Yeah.
If you are in a room of 25 kids and only one person gets to talk at a time, you may have 7 or 8 kids talk in a whole class period. What are the other ones doing? The other ones are bored to death and hating you and the ones that got to talk. They didn't have a chance to participate in the learning process, and therefore they've learned nothing.
So now what happens? You do the same thing. You put a question out there. You put it in a structure. Now what does it look like?
It depends on what the question is and how I want it answered. But let's just say that I put a question out there that doesn't need a lot of think time, that doesn't need a lot of explanation. They need to make a list. So I can have them with their partner do a rally robin back and forth where both of them get to talk. They get to say a one-word answer, and I'll give them 30 seconds. Well, now every person in the classroom has gotten to give 10 answers to the one question, and they've gotten to listen to 10 answers. So not only have they had the chance to talk, but they've had the chance to listen to someone else's thoughts, and every person in the classroom has participated.
The greatest thing in the world is doing that with, you know, a class that is really social.
Yes.
When you have those kids, when you have a bunch of them that are all super smart and they all want to prove how smart they are, awesome. Prove it to each other. You don't need to yell at me and yell over each other.
Absolutely. And they want to prove it to each other, yeah. I think, almost as much as they want to prove it to us. Kids like for other kids to think that they're smart.
Mm-hmm.
Even the kid that is the behavior issue, that says he never reads, that doesn't want to be at school, he likes to share. That kid still likes to share and loves when someone praises them.
Mm-hmm. So let's get to the actual use of structures. Because by now, you're either sold on it or not if you're listening to this podcast. If this sounds great, you're in it. But if not, then you can just go somewhere else. Because now we're getting into it. So when you're using a structure, let's say for the first time.
Okay.
How can a teacher plan for success? Say, let's do rally robin, since you already mentioned it.
Okay.
It's Kagan structure.
Yes.
Right, where they go back and forth and speak.
Yes.
How do you set that up for success the best you can the first time you're trying a structure? What elements do you need to make sure as the teacher before you even try it?
you have to have a question that has several answers. Do not ask something.
Who's the main character of this story?
Do not ask something that there are three answers to, and then they're going to be looking at each other. Multiple answers. You want to explain it. You want to model it with something really fun. When I do Rally Robin, I model it first with Superhero Challenge. And there's always some little boy that loves superheroes, and I go up against them to see who is going to have to stop and think first about a superhero. So the Superhero Challenge works really well, and it captures them because they are shocked that I know superheroes. And I technically don't know superheroes. I just remember a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I have no idea who the people are that I'm throwing out there. And sometimes they stomp me because they'll say one that's next in my list, and I'm like, well, I don't know anymore. So a good answer that captures them, you want to model it twice the very first time that you do it. I think modeling it with two different people with two different kinds of answers does something for the different types of learners. So I model it twice. Then I have them try it with something that I know everyone can do. Everyone can be successful. Something like your favorite candy or your favorite ice cream. All of them can answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Every single person in the classroom can be successful. Once you build that capacity for every single person to be successful, now they're willing to try anything. Then you can give them what they actually need to be talking about, whatever academic that you want them to do.
If there were key structures that you would say to start with for someone who's just kind of like, all right, I want to start, I see the benefit of this, I really want to start using this. What are some key structures that you would use and why?
Well, the two key structures that anyone should use and that I probably use every single day are Rally Robin and Round Robin. And Rally Robin is with their partner, either face or shoulder partner. It does not matter. And it's that list back and forth where each of them give one answer.
Mm-hmm.
Every single person is talking. And a Round Robin, they're working as their table team. So all four of them are giving an answer. And you start with person number one, and then person number two gives an answer, then three, then four. Everyone is still talking, but it's in a larger group. Those can be done every single day with something. A lot of times if I'm giving them information, which the days that I think that structures are needed most are the days when you're introducing something where I'm going to have to talk a little more than I usually do.
Mm-hmm.
Have them review what you just said. You give them three definitions, have them review and give examples, have them do something to take a brain break in the middle and say, well, how many colors could this be? And they will name it off. They like to talk, so they're going to name whatever you ask them for. I like to do before they read, because we usually do a word association before they read, some word out of the title that generally everybody knows, and do some sort of association with it. What could this be about? And they can give one word what this could be about. I do it in the reading. It depends on what we're reading about and if it's a fiction or a nonfiction topic. Of course, it's easier with fiction topics.
Mm-hmm.
Nonfiction topics usually tend to be more meaty. They need a little more guidance. They need the dictionary a lot more. The vocabulary is a little more tough. So it just really depends on the timing and how far we're getting and how I want them to do something. Now, I also use it as a reading tool. They can alternate paragraphs when they're reading, and it's just like a Rally Robin. It's just a little longer, but they're just with their partner. And I don't call that a Rally Robin. They're just doing partner reading where they alternate paragraphs. Well, still, everyone in the classroom is talking. Everyone is sharing. They can do that as a whole table. So sometimes we do it just with our reading. There's not something else to go along with it. It's just to get through reading the passage and annotate as we go.
So let me ask you this. If you have, and I'm asking this specifically because the last episode we did here was ELL's newcomers,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have kids all over the place not 100% solid on their English skills, both writing and reading, and speaking. Mm-hmm. So you have, when you have a group like that, and you have like one student who, you know, maybe be a newcomer who doesn't talk a lot, or an ELL mm-hmm. who's very shy because they speak kind of broken English or something. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that in these social situations where you have them interacting with each other?
That's where I generally place myself. My proximity to them is usually very close. At least the first couple of times that we do this, it's scary to not be sure what to say in a group where you feel like everyone is looking at you for a second. Mm-hmm. So I generally will, you know, be very near them and help them. I try to do something when we're modeling that they're going to know also. And I try to encourage my students to help each other. And sometimes, you know, with an ELL, we do have to, you know, we have to just talk them through it. It's not a breakdown of the structure for three other students to help one student learn something. That's actually an achievement within a structure. If the students know an answer, they could just pass him over and go on, but they stop and they try to talk them through, you know, what that question means, what they should answer, or I will have that ELL repeat an answer that they've already heard. They are still learning by repeating, mm-hmm. and they are still participating. So they can repeat something that they've heard also. But I try to encourage them to throw it out there and to participate and not be afraid of that. And it's a struggle sometimes. But usually, if I see it's being a struggle, repeating always helps them to feel like they can participate.
Okay. Another curveball for you.
Yes.
What if, and I actually had this problem this year for a little bit, but what if you have a student who has, like, extreme social anxiety? So if this was my wife and we were doing this, like, she would probably be okay for a little bit, but deep down she's having a heart attack because she's having to speak. Even if, like, you know, she'd be completely fine. But what if they don't even get to that point? What if their anxiety is so much that all they can do is, like, just stare, and everything they are controlling is just not breaking down and crying or breaking down and, you know, like putting their head on their desk. How do you get that student to come out of their shell?
I actually had a student this year. Their parent told me at Meet the Teacher that that would be happening. I think I've had a student every year for the last 2 or 3 years where a parent told me, oh, she's not going to talk. She's not going to participate. She's not. And I'm like, okay, yeah, yes, she will. because that really is just my attitude about it. It may take me some time, but they're going to participate. I've had students that are terrified of saying something that I've had write something down. So on their turn, they scribble it down and hold it up. They're still participating. They haven't said anything, but they're still 100% participating. I've had students to where I'll do a buddy system where they can whisper it to another student and they get to say their answer for them. That works if you have an uneven number. It generally doesn't work if you have an even number of students, and, you know, because you need that one student that's kind of not giving their own original answers. Mm-hmm. They're repeating the answers for that person. I've even had a student that I let turn their chair away from the group and say their answer. They just could not stand having everyone look at them. Mm-hmm. And once he was able to turn his chair away and basically be facing the wall, he was totally fine doing his answers because now all the eyes weren't on him. So I kind of play around with it. When I see that that's happening, I try to meet with the student after class or, you know, talk to their parent. But every student's going to participate some way. We're going to figure out a way for every student to participate. You just have to see the level of anxiety and work around that, because there's anxiety that, oh, I'm a little nervous. And then there's, I'm about to pass out.
Yeah.
So you have to work to see what's going to help with making them comfortable.
So, question. So say you trying a new structure. You've tried it maybe three times.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, maybe you get it to work again. Maybe like the fourth time it works. And then a little bit later, it starts to kind of fall apart again. How do you troubleshoot why a structure is not working? Like, what are the points of intersection that could break down a structure that teachers should look at if they're, maybe they try a round robin and every time there's some type of break or they're not getting the response that they're getting, that they want from their students? What should a teacher be looking for if they're having struggles with keeping a structure together and making it work?
Well, failure of structures is a part of it. I have tried structures that I'm like, yes, this is going to be awesome. I have the best question. And it has been horrible. Like, run home to my mama and cry horrible. So failure of your structures is going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's inevitable. I generally, if a structure is going to fall apart on me, it's because I have gone too fast through the instructions and left out something. I left out telling them what to do when they're finished. I left out telling them how much time they had. I didn't display the time. It's generally something that I've left out that makes it fall apart, where they then go, what are we supposed to do? And I'm like, oh, I didn't tell them. I try to go through and make notes for my directions so that that doesn't happen. If I've tried it three times and it has failed all three times, I'm going back to the table. I'm asking somebody for help. I am emailing somebody. I am calling somebody. I'm doing something to find out what I'm doing wrong. If it's gone wrong twice, the third time, I'm recording it. I'm going to have to look at video to see what I'm doing wrong. I spend a lot of time outside of my classroom prepping for my structures, especially if it's one that I don't use as much. I don't prep for rally robin and round robin, and there are a few that I use all the time that I don't prep for. I just put them in, and I know how to explain them because I've used them so many times. But if it falls apart, you have to just start over and go step by step for what you're doing. My suggestion is, when you start using structures, that you do record it, that you take the time to record yourself, because you don't know what you are doing and what you're conveying by your body language. I sometimes will say a direction and I will point a different way that makes them think, oh, that's what we're supposed to do. And I'm just really moving my arm while I'm talking. I'm not actually pointing to something, but they have taken it as, she wants us to move to the right. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? And they're like, well, you said go this way. And I said, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. You pointed when you were talking. And I'm like, oh, okay. So you have to be mindful of your actions when given directions, because they take everything and think that you are giving them an instruction at that moment.
I think that's great advice.
It happens. It's happened to me more than once. I talk with my hands. So yeah. I'm constantly pointing and I'm not really meaning to point. So the students then take it as, oh, okay, that's what we're supposed to. And I am baffled and I'm like, what are y'all doing? And they're like, well, you told us to. And I'm like, no, I didn't. And it, you know, a couple of times it's caused an issue. And I'm like, I did not tell you that. And then someone will do what I did. And I'm like, oh, I did tell you that, but with my body language, not with my mouth. I'm sorry. So making sure that you are very conscious of what you look like and what you are saying is highly important. Record yourself before you do it.
Some people hate being recorded.
I hate being recorded. But it makes a difference. And even if I record it and I'm the only person that ever sees it, it's worth it for me. I've recorded and I'm the only one that sees it. I've recorded and sent it to other people. I've recorded and sent it to Kagan, actual trainers, to ask what I'm doing wrong. You will never be able to capture that time in your mind that you think you're remembering what you did wrong as much as a video can.
Final question. A teacher that's looking to add structure or looking to just get better at structures.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't have the infrastructure like we do at RMS. We have trainers all over the place. We've, you know, everyone's been to Kagan. We have Kagan trainers,
yes.
Stuff like that. So maybe you know, people listen to this, they don't have that infrastructure. What would be your advice to someone who wants to get better at structures? What are some resources that teachers can reach out to or get that would enhance their own personal professional development with structure? Stuff that you know is successful enough for them to use.
Well, the fidelity of Kagan in what they do is unmatched. If there is any possible way that you can get to a Kagan training, that is the first resource you need to do. Mm-hmm. They give scholarships. They will let you, you know, come in to observe. They will help you. So that is the first thing. If you possibly can get into a Kagan training, go to it. There is no better help than those trainers that are absolutely top-notch at what they do. If you can't do that, I would say the next thing is to go on YouTube. There are Kagan structures all over YouTube by some of the finest trainers that Kagan employs. Some of their videos are on YouTube. You have to be careful with YouTube videos, of course, because you have someone on there who thinks they're doing it right, and mm-hmm. they are really messing it up, which means that you're going to watch that and learn and mess it up too. So you really have to be careful with that. Find someone who has been to the training to explain it to you. Find someone who knows what they are doing to help you through doing some of it. There are some of them that I don't believe that you can do unless you've actually been to the training for it. There are some upper level structures that they can't be explained unless you experience it and get the knowledge from a Kagan trainer. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't even be able to explain it in a way that you would be able to pull it off with me just explaining it to you. So talking to people, participating in it yourself, doing it with adults is very helpful. I felt like I was pretty good at structures in my classroom with my children, and my kids were loving it, and it was great. And when I applied to become a Kagan school trainer, I had to do it with adults, and I quickly saw where my holes were, because adults they're like, I don't understand what you're saying. And they will say it right then. Kids will just shake their head yes and go along with it. Adults are like, that's not gonna work. So do it with adults, because they're gonna give you great feedback, and it's gonna hurt a little bit, but the feedback will be invaluable.
Thank you, Keisha, for being here today. I appreciate it so much. Everyone's going to appreciate it too. It's some hardcore advice in your episode. And you're just beaming right now because you're so happy you helped everyone.
Thank you, Jacob.
Anyway, for everyone else, thank you for listening to this episode of Teach Me Teacher. Go to teachmeteacherpodcast.com to where you can get everything, not miss one thing on the podcast. Every week we're bringing new episodes to help you with no-nonsense advice from teachers in the classroom. Make sure to go to iTunes, subscribe to us, leave us a review, hit that 5-star rating if you believe that it was 5 stars. Otherwise, share this with your team. Have a good one.